Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. We look today at the evidence of ancient cultures that settled and lived on the North American continent long before Christopher Columbus. These cultures were known to live on this land prior to some Native American Indians. A controversial yet well-known repository of ancient artifacts is located in a cave in south-central Illinois. The cave was discovered in 1925 by an individual named Orville Lowry, and it's filled with thousands of artifacts and alleged tombs. We're joined today by Harry Hubbard to talk about this cave, its artifacts, and historic context. In his research, Harry Hubbard has been kind of a steward of this repository, cataloging, researching, and bringing forth the data to the public worldwide. His work is often dismissed or ignored by archaeologists and anthropologists. We talk about why that might be. He's pored through many rare books and has also worked to translate the script carved in the hundreds of stones found in the cave. The major claim by Harry and his colleagues is that this is the tomb of Alexander the Great and Cleopatra. Harry is the author of two books, one titled Ancient Mediterranean Treasure in North America, Tomb Chronicles, Volume 1, and the second book, The Curse of Alexander's Tomb, Tomb Chronicles, Volume 2. Harry Hubbard, welcome to Another News.
Thank you.
If you could, just take listeners on a virtual tour of the general area of the Lost Tomb, where it's located, and describe the landscape.
Okay. It's quite remote. The region here is quite remote. It's not heavily populated. There's a lot of farmland, a lot of corn crops, a lot of soybean crops. And what isn't planted commercially is pretty much rough woods, ravines, streams, and small rivers. The Skillet Fork River is pretty near the site. All the fields have like a runoff, and the runoff goes into what you'd call ravines that are surrounded by woods, and they're too rough to plow for fields or anything like that. So what isn't pretty much arable is kind of rough with hills, and the ravines are probably anywhere from, I would say 15 to 40 feet deep. Lots of trees here, a lot of timber, and just not a lot of infrastructure at all.
Okay. You've done a lot of research and a lot of work putting together material to get information out to the public about the artifacts in this cave. Part of the work includes a number of videos that you've posted on YouTube. One of them's titled Tomb Tape Roman Numeral 4, and you've gone through a lot of script here that was etched in the stones that were found in this cave. And would you give listeners an idea of what the script denotes and of its significance historically?
Sure. Tomb Tape 4 is actually a compilation taken from Tomb Tape 3 and several other different videos, and had a few extra decipherments in there. The actual original Tomb Tape 3, and it was called Tomb Tape 3 because it was our third take. And then there was actually another addition to that. And so I wanted to put everything together, make it a little bit shorter. The initial Tomb Tape 3 was like 2 hours long. So I put together Tomb Tape 4, which is, I think, only an hour and 15 minutes long, and covers a lot more ground and covered more footage from times that we'd spent out at the site. And there had been many scholars that had studied these tablets and the writing on them, the scripted tablets and the symbology and things like that, for a lot longer than we had, years before we had come on the scene. And I first purchased the Mystery Cave Many Faces book from David Hatcher Childress, I believe, in 1991, first part of 1991. And I had looked at it, and I'd studied, you know, ancient alphabets and such, and it looked to me like some Punic characters, some Latin characters, but there wasn't enough really to study, per se. And then when I teamed up with Paul, after I'd met him, then he was fluent in many, like eight modern languages. And he also had studied ancient Latin alphabets and ancient Punic, Egyptian hieroglyphs and stuff like that from in his earlier years. So we kind of meshed together and hit it right off. And he started looking at the scripted tablets out of the books, and I ordered a couple of other books, and then I ordered some pictures, and he busted the language, or the primary language, on the stones in June of 1994. And basically the story that the stones and the tablets depict is that there was a huge colony that came out of northern Africa slash the Mediterranean area. Many different types of peoples that had come over here after Octavian took to rule, probably between 30 and 20 BC. And it was not just a few, it wasn't a handful, it was like an armada, a flotilla, just thousands and thousands of people to escape persecution under Octavian. And they were led here by a missing son of Queen of Queens Cleopatra and Mark Antony. Their oldest son's name was Alexander Helios. And he'd also brought over the family Sema, the cadavers of his forefathers, and which included his mother, Queen of Queens Cleopatra, and Alexander the Great. And one of the things that really gets me is that some people will come up and say, well, Alexander the Great had been dead for 300 years before Cleopatra. And they are ignorant of history to not realize that they were all one lineage. And Queen of Queens Cleopatra was a descendant of Ptolemy Soter I, who was a half-brother to Alexander the Great. And they don't understand that this lineage was all related. They don't have a clue. And they're not able to connect the dots. And we had connected the dots and came out with the fact that this tomb in southern Illinois was truly the Ptolemaic dynasty, including Alexander the Great and Queen of Queens Cleopatra. In late June 1994, as I think when we filed the documentation with an attorney in Florida, and we were the first people to ever make the claim that we had located Alexander the Great's tomb. There had been no one in throughout history prior to Paul and I that made such a claim. And since we had made the claim, there have been 17 pseudo claims that they found Alexander the Great and Queen of Queens Cleopatra's graves or tombs, and none of them have panned out to be anything. Here one day and gone the next. 17. We have to keep track of these numbers. And they all came after. The first one was, I believe it was 7 months after we made our claim.
Let's step back for a second and go back to the site in southern Illinois, this repository. You actually didn't get a chance to go inside the cave. However, you've been in touch with people who have excavated the artifacts and have been collecting them and purchasing them as well. Can you give listeners some idea of that process there?
Well, what happened was back in the early 80s, if somebody went and purchased a metal detector, they were to be presented with a couple of free treasure guides to stimulate sales of these metal detectors that were coming on the scene. And back then, the first generation of metal detectors, they weren't that powerful, so they had to, you know, get people more interested in it. So there was a fellow from Olney, Illinois, who had purchased such a metal detector, and he was given two free treasure guides that both featured areas in Illinois and Indiana and such like that. And he was looking through it, you know, areas close to where he lived in Olney, and he found a place that was in Marion County And two different treasure guides, the same place was indicated from two different directions. So what he did was is he correlated those two positions and then got a good idea of where this was at. He traveled down here to the area, and it was actually a local lady and her husband that took him to the actual site where he actually relocated the entrance to this tomb. And he had been in it, and to my knowledge, perhaps his brother-in-law and maybe two other guys had been in it, but they were in for a short time. But overall, it was just one person that was pulling out the artifacts and selling them to whoever would purchase them from him.
Give us a year on that.
1982. 83, 84, 85. And it appears that in either late 1986, he would only do his nighttime looting from late spring to early fall, because that was when the weather was more conducive. You know, warm enough without getting, you know, cold, without getting marred in the mud and things of that nature. And it appears that in 1987, or late 1986 or 1987, is when he actually discovered gold, or when he started pulling gold out. He may have actually seen it prior to then, but I don't think so. I think he would have been selling it much sooner. But by 1987, he started pulling out gold pieces, and medallions, pendants, coins, bricks or blocks with script on them, just all kinds of stuff with this unknown language.
There's also another year of 1925.
Correct.
What is the significance of that year?
Okay, in 1925, there was a farmer named Orville Lowry, a local resident of Hickory Hill, Illinois. And this was back right before the Dust Bowl. And he was in the area with his two daughters, and they were picking up rocks and artifacts in order to plant what they called a truck patch, which is a garden that will yield the back of a pickup truck in vegetables. And they had been picking up stones and throwing them in the back of the truck when one of his daughters had actually discovered the hole that went down into the ground that had some writing on it. And he had tried to get people interested. The state of Illinois, they scoffed him off. And he was able to get it entered into the records in the courthouse, some way, somehow. Those records now are missing, of what they called the WAPA papers, which there was, at the time in the 30s, part of Roosevelt's New Deal, there was one person in each township that was actually hired by the government or paid by the government to go through and record local history. And what he did was, as Orville Lowry had gone to him and told him the story, and that person had logged it into the courthouse records some way, somehow. And then in the early 60s, there was a man named Michael Paul Henson. Michael Paul Henson was the premier treasure hunter book writer of North America. And he was editor-in-chief of Lost Treasure magazine for years and years up until his death in 1993. And he had a knack of going into these courthouses or these WAPA papers and researching and finding old ghost towns or ancient dwellings or things of that nature. And so he recorded them in treasure books. And so that's how Orville Lowry, his daughter's discovery back in 1925, actually came to fruition in the early 60s. And then again was published in the late 60s and 70s and 80s. It was all in treasure books. This site had been known since 1925. It had been in treasure books since the mid-60s and on up into the 70s and 80s. It was no secret.
What do you think is going on in terms of the government or institutions being concerned of the historic context of what this repository contains. You would think that they would rope this off and it would be a huge museum right here that would add to the history books.
Oh, absolutely not. They are locked into a paradigm as if there was no civilization here before Columbus, which Columbus never set foot on the American continent, the soil of North America. It's quite contrary. They want to stay locked in their paradigms because their paradigms are easy. It also has some ramifications historically that if someone was here, then that would make the Mayflower Compact or the Mayflower Charter null and void, and so many of our other documents, because since the Roman times, every document concerning a piece of land has to be, I guess, taken into consideration before the next piece of paper. It all has to do with Latin law, and a lot of those laws were brought down and handed to us from our forefathers. So the easy paradigm is that there was no one here, no Mediterranean presence before Columbus or the Spanish landed in St. Augustine. Even though classical historians such as Pliny and Diodorus Siculus, they write about a massive land, many days' sail out into the Atlantic Ocean. It appears to be well documented, and even if you look at the Johannes Rusch map that Columbus had, that had been printed, okay, I guess, what, 16 years before Columbus sailed, it has Cape Cod on it. The Johannes Rusch map had Cape Cod on it. Hmm. And then it had what appeared to be an outline of Cuba on it, but it was called Japango. So they thought that Cuba was Japan, and they thought that Cape Cod was just a part of China. So many ancient authors had recorded quite accurately the circumference of the earth, and the way they measured it was quite ingenious. Columbus just was looking for the missing 8 hours that was on the map he had. That was it. And we document that in the Laseria map video. And I guess that's what got Paul more interested back into the script, studying the script from this cave in Illinois, was the fact that we had discovered that Columbus was just looking for the missing 8 hours.
Harry, tell listeners who Paul is.
Paul Shafranca, my study partner, research partner, and a good friend. He's a brilliant soul. He's got an IQ probably 190 plus, 195. He's a chess champion, speaks 8 languages fluently, and reads them, speaks them, writes them. And he knows probably off the cuff 30 to 33 ancient alphabets, read them, write them. And I'm on a good day maybe 10. And many of them are similar. So we cover a lot of ground together. He's a fast reader. I'm a fast reader. He has a brilliant memory. So that's who Paul Shafranca is. You can read his bio on our webpage, which is IllinoisCaves.com.
IllinoisCaves.com. All right, let's get back to this ancient repository in southern Illinois. Why, Harry, do you suspect this area was chosen?
I think that I really don't know. Anything I say would be speculation. I haven't seen anything that was, we haven't seen a tablet that indicated why they landed here. I would say probably because it's in the 38th parallel, they could probably deduce by the nighttime stars, perhaps similar to what they had in the northern Mediterranean region. But that's entirely speculative.
What types of bodies of water are near this location?
The Skillet-Fort River is the closest river of any size. The Skillet-Fort River runs into the Little Wabash River. The Little Wabash River runs into the Big Wabash River. The Big Wabash runs into the Ohio to Mississippi, on and on.
You have a lot of river systems. Do you think this was related to maybe why this area was chosen?
Quite possibly. There are many, many map stones that indicate that clearly show the route that they took.
If you could describe some of those, some of the script on those stones and the stream systems that were depicted.
That's a pretty interesting story. It appears that some of the script, like around a lot of the script on the map stones, is similar. There's where the Arkansas River is. It says like Black Lake or Black Swamp. And we learned later that years ago the Arkansas River does flow black water at times. There's one that goes, it says a Temple of Ra on it. And the map stones also indicate several ancient cities. And these ancient cities were actually later in the early and mid-1800s were actually documented by the Smithsonian Institute. So you can actually take the maps that the Smithsonian Institute made and compare them to these ancient maps, and some of the civilizations are quite honestly the same.
You talk about this in one of your videos, and it's really fascinating how a lot of data was recorded or inscripted on these rocks. Tell us how big these rocks are that have the script of streams and river systems on them.
They're probably 6 inches round. Most of the tablets are like 6 inches, 5 inches round, 7 inches, 8 inches round, and not completely round circle, but kind of like slabish, circular overall, but rough circles, not really pure. And there's many that are smaller, you know, decent, you know, you'd take your two hands to look at to hold them.
How were you able to determine that this was a tomb of Alexander the Great and Cleopatra?
Well, it's a combination of things. First of all, the man who was first looting it, he had written with two other people, had published a couple of books that indicated that there were 13 crypts. One of them had a woman, and that in the main crypt, the cadaver was entombed in a solid gold coffin, meaning a hollowed-out type King Tut-type coffin. And that's one thing, is there's not too many kings from ancient times that said to have been interred in a solid gold coffin. There were other tablets that came up that actually say, well, there's one that says Ptolemy Soter the First, Aletes Teva, and then there's also the tablets that say Queen of Queens, Cleopatra. She's not known as Cleopatra. Her name is actually written on these stones as Cleopatra, mother of Helios the king. And then a lot of the stones were Helios, Alexander Helios. And there's also stones that clearly have Alexander the Great on them. But he wasn't known as Alexander the Great. He was known as Alexander of Pella or Alexandros Magnus. And in Egyptian glyph, there are several of the cartouches that go Mary Amun Setep in Ra Alexandris, which is in the living image of the sun god Ra, or son of Ra, Alexander. So, and there are several of these tablets. It's a who's who of ancient Roman and Greek history. And there's a lot of Persian kings that listed in there, too. And it shows their profiles, their pictures, in a more contemporary-type fashion. And it has their name on it. A lot of times you'll see a person's head on it, and, well, their name is on the front of it, too.
Now, in one of your videos online, you talk about that there are about four ancient languages from this tomb: Archaic, Latin, Numidian, Glyph, Demotic, and Greek. Can you go through those just to give listeners an idea of some of the work that you had to do to transliterate, to translate, and decode?
Well, we used alphabets from L.A. Waddell and Encyclopedia Britannica, which those ancient alphabets go hand in hand, because L.A. Waddell he was curator of the British Museum, and British Museum is tied in with Britannica. And Paul, with his knowledge of Latin, he began to write down the letters and then make combinations of these letters and then figure out which direction, because some of them go up, some of them go down, some of them go back and forth. The lion's share of them go from right to left. They go in retrograde, as did ancient Latin. And so he would start putting the words together, speaking them phonetically, and then he busted the script. And from there, it was pretty much a done deal. Then we knew what to look for. Like, for instance, if you see a Q out of let's say there's three or four different written Qs, you look for a U. If there's a U close to that Q, you know that's what direction the script is written. And like A's, for instance, whatever direction that A is written, that'll give you a clue as to which direction the script is going. There's all kinds of little things like that, like a X's, S's, and SN's, or S's, SN's in a word or a sentence. There's all kinds of little clues that that someone can use to decipher the text.
Well, one of your hypotheses is that Alexandro Helios, Cleopatra's son, brought the repository to the North American continent.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about what your thoughts are of that historic time and what might have been going on?
Well, when Octavian took power after Mark Antony and Cleopatra were deceased, it's recorded that 160,000 souls were sacrificed. Well, there was a lot of persecution, and a lot of people were ready to go. And as the Roman Empire expanded, for some reason, a lot of the population numbers were going down. And Mark Antony's army did not want to serve under Octavian, not at all. And so, and Octavian didn't want to keep a bunch of mutinous legionnaires under him, so it kind of worked out. Now, what happened was, is Octavia, who was Octavian's sister, was a very wonderful woman. Okay, she was a brilliant woman, beautiful, all these wonderful things. She was married to Mark Antony. Well, after Cleopatra and Mark Antony were dead, all right, she says, well, because I am Mark Antony's legal wife, that means his children belong to me. And Mark Antony had three children from Cleopatra. Are you with me?
Yes.
Okay, so she brought in and adopted those three children as her own and took them into the palace in Rome, and they were paraded in the triumph in gold chains, but they were treated as foreign hostages and given food, warm comfort, board, and everything like that. And Octavia raised them as her own. At the same time, okay, now Alexander Helios and his twin sister, Cleopatra Selene, were born in like 40, 41 BC. So they were at this time like 10 years old. So at the same time, from a previous triumph of Julius Caesar had conquered King Juba I. He had, as hostage, King Juba II, and Octavian inherited Juba II, and it was in his palace. Okay, Juba II was this brilliant genius, great guy from his father. He was born and raised, you know, Mauritania, and he was quite a valiant man and showed himself in great service to Octavian. And so what happened was, is Juba II fell in love with Cleopatra Selene, vice versa, and they got married. And then they bore a child also, or a couple of kids also. Well, King Juba II, well, he was granted his homeland back to rule by Octavian, with tribuneship and all the satrap governor, with all the advantages and disadvantages of being under the yoke of the Roman Empire. Okay, fine. And King Juba II assisted Helios, who was his brother-in-law, with the logistics and ships and everything to make way and leave the Mediterranean area. And evidently, thousands of people went with them.
We're speaking with Harry Hubbard about the South Central Illinois caves. We'll be right back after this break. Just tuned in, our guest is Harry Hubbard, and we're talking about the South Central Illinois Cave and the alleged tombs of Alexander the Great and Cleopatra. The theory is that they made it across the Atlantic Ocean to the North American continent. Is there evidence of an area where they might have come to shore on the Atlantic seaboard?
There's mounds and such, and ancient Mediterranean relics and artifacts found all over this country. The powers that be keep it all under wraps as much as possibly they can, until this repository came up. And these artifacts that we're talking about, they've been sold all over the world since the mid-'80s.
It doesn't seem to me that the powers that be are doing a really good job in suppressing this information. They put it on the repository on a treasure map that was available to people, and it was, in essence, just a matter of someone coming to find it, which they did.
Nobody knew, had a clue of what it was until Paul busted the script in 1994, and by then the cat was out of the bag. It was already too late.
This particular area, Harry, is interesting. I just started doing some research and looking around southern Illinois and the river systems, it's quite amazing. But I noticed that the area where the repository is called Little Egypt. And then there's a city named Cairo, and there's Memphis, Tennessee.
Well, there's also, I think, Pyramid Lake, Alexander Lake, there's Alexander County. There's a lot. And there are many stories that go back to the early 1800s concerning that there was a famine in the northern part of the state, and then people migrated down to the southern part of the state where food was plentiful, and so they figured it, you know, the deal with Joseph and his 12 brothers that had come down to get food. And I don't believe so. There's been other people who have found ancient Egyptian artifacts all up and down the Ohio, the Mississippi rivers, and I believe that it's quite possible. They're finding hieroglyphics in Egyptian hieroglyphs in Nova Scotia and up in Canada, and I believe that perhaps some Mennonite kid or an Amish kid years and years ago had found some Egyptian medallions or something, and there's a record of such being found in New York State and in different places here in North America. And I believe it's probably folklore from some of that, that perhaps a few people in one of the counties here or some boys had found some amulets with Egyptian hieroglyphic writing on them, or even gold for that matter. And back in the 1800s, when you didn't have internet, nobody knew nothing, barely had newspapers, the area here was still totally riddled with Native American or Amerindians until the early 1820s. This area here was inhabited by the Kickapoo up until last war with the Kicks was in 1820.
Well, you mentioned how the Bureau of Ethnology, after it collects artifacts, essentially gives a green light for people to build barns and houses and churches over ancient sites.
Correct.
It's interesting because this is the basic storyline for many horror films, like the Amityville Horror or Poltergeist. Are there stories like that, strange paranormal experiences, when they find that a structure is built over these ancient tombs or ancient areas?
quite possible. Where I live here with my wife, our cats and dog, is an ancient settlement. And there was one fella that said he had seen some apparitions walking across our backyard before, you know. So it's quite possible. I haven't heard of anything. There's been some strange stuff happening down in the southern counties of Illinois. There's actually several books of prairie ghosts, folklore of southern Illinois, ghosts of Illinois, on and on. There's many books printed, even on back into the early 1900s concerning the subject.
In your video, The Cobras of Columbus, in that presentation, you really share the bigger context of the river systems related to the site at southern Illinois, which is fascinating because you can see how the river systems interconnect. Can you talk about that significance?
Well, the emphasis of that that entire presentation is how much of it there is, how many thousands and thousands, as many as half a million mounds and ancient cities are right here. And, you know, they will attribute to, Native Americans, but when the Europeans got here, the Native Americans, they didn't live on these mounds. They were quite nomadic. And there was not anything of construct. I believe it's in the early 1700s when the Natchez down in middle Mississippi and upper Mississippi, that they actually did rituals and rites on mounds with their and their king lived on a mound. And a lot of these mounds are in floodplains too. That's how come they're so easy to pick out on maps and such. There are some mounds here in southern Illinois that are half a mile wide and as much as a mile and a half long. And they're step-tiered mounds. And they're all over the place. There's a mound just south of us here that is like 14 acres, upwards of 20 acres, which is larger than Monk's Mound. And there are several mounds that are much larger than Monk's Mound. Not quite as high, but much larger at the base. They're everywhere.
Right. That's a really great presentation, Cobras of Columbus.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a really great, very in-depth. It's called Cobras of Columbus. Listeners, if you want to check that out, it's on Harry's YouTube channel. Just type in Harry Hubbard. You know, related to this, you talk about a certain group of people that were found in the mountains of Western Carolina and East Tennessee by French traders in the late 1600s. Can you talk about those people?
The Melungeons. And, I started more controversy with that along the or near the Clinch River up on Newman's Ridge. And the thing about it was is these people were quite isolated. You had to cross a deep gorge, go down one side and go back up the other side to get to this plateau that stretched, like 25, 30 miles or so. And it was quite rough. And the Cherokee Empire was on the southern brink of that plateau. So the Europeans were not able to penetrate into that until like the 1800s. And they were olive-colored skinned, I guess what you'd say of today, the Greek skin-colored tone. Some of the English settlers could understand some of the words they had. And they were farmers. They were actually, they found several buildings in there, too, which will probably come to light as more time is, unless the powers that be wanted to what extent they want to cover up what was found there, which is part of what Cobras of Columbus does or presents, is what the people who live there have found and how the Smithsonian and the anthropologists and the archaeologists just slough it off as nothing. So like the Alexander the Great coins that they found in northern Tennessee there. And they found Alexander the Great coins and Ptolemy coins all over Missouri, Alabama, Mississippi, Illinois. I document several of them in Cobras of Columbus.
The Melungeon people, they lived in cabins, I understand. They had blue eyes. Some had brown eyes. They spoke broken English, as you mentioned, and claimed to speak Portuguese.
Or a Latinized. If a group of people had a lot of Latin words in their vocabulary, then the old British or French possibly could have understood many of the words they were talking about. And, yeah, they also wore clothes, which was the most amazing thing. They had beards, and they wore clothes, which the settlers had really a time trying to figure that one out, because the Native Americans, they wore, you know, lower tunics, and they did not wear trousers and shirts as such of the European style, but the Melungeons did.
Most Native Americans didn't have beards, as you pointed out.
Correct, and they did not live in cabins.
It's really interesting. I like this area because I'm wondering where the Native Americans come in terms of when they begin to settle certain areas and where some of these possibly Mediterranean or North African settlers came in. Where is the timeline there?
That's up for speculation. You know, there's always the... There's always the big push that all the Europeans came here and pushed the Indians out and the Amerindians and did this and did that. Well, my question is who'd they get it from? I mean, look at all those buildings out in the American Southwest, all these vast metropolis and all these vast mounds and vast ancient buildings and ancient dwellings, even in this area here. Well, evidently they were routed by the Native Americans. So who did they get it from?
Well, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because I've often heard by scholars of ancient worlds talk about an Egyptian settlement in the Grand Canyon, and I've never seen images of it. You just see reference to it online, maybe. Is there a connection to what you've uncovered in your translations and transliteration of the script and that?
Quite possibly. I cover that entire issue in the presentation, Grand Canyon Cultures and Conflict, which is a pay-per-view video on Zach Taylor's channel, which is ZTT Consulting. I cover it. I show you pictures of it. And I go in and I show you how I deduced where it was and how it was and History Channel did a real sloppy job on that, not only that presentation, but my own presentation as well. If the History Channel has something really interesting and a subject that's really good, they just kind of squeeze it out like a sponge. There's just nothing there. But if they have a real crappy subject that doesn't really make any sense or just something that's just absolutely asinine, then they'll try to blow that and expound upon it get intricate in it and put Templars on it. And try to make it very interesting, you know. So there's like some news reporters, for instance, they take a real good story and make it boring, and take a real bad story and make it just wonderful, you know. So, and that's what they do.
So you get into this area a little bit in this pay-per-view video, but could you tell us something here about the connection with what you found, and does this place really exist in the Grand Canyon?
Well, that's what I go into with the video, is that it wasn't a cave as such in the Grand Canyon, but there were hundreds of them. That's the thing about it. There were so many, and that's why I believe they closed it all off, is because there were so many hikers and trail books that showed you how to get there, that there was people getting hurt, twisted ankles, broken arms. And the novice people and trash people were, you know, trashing the place out. They just closed off the entire area. And as far as a connection, it would just be speculative.
But the idea is that there are Egyptian artifacts found in the Grand Canyon as well.
That is correct, but I haven't seen any. All we have is folklore. But I'm sure that there are people who live in Arizona, New Mexico, whose forefathers actually hiked the Grand Canyon at different points in the 20s and 30s, 40s and 50s, who did get some amazing artifacts. And they're probably, a lot of people, a lot of collectors, they don't want to show you their artifacts because they figure that you're going to tell somebody in the state's going to come and get it or throw it away. And then throw them in a pile or discard them or just get rid of them, throw them away, trash them, break them up, because it won't fit their paradigm. And it's what they what the Smithsonian does in cases like large humanoids, giants, or even little people, tiny people or smaller people, 2 feet tall. They don't want you to know that these people existed or these races of people existed. They just want you to believe that it was all Native Americans, and they figure we got enough problems that way. We don't want to rock the boat too much.
I was going to ask you about that. What are your thoughts on the efforts by secret groups, clubs, organizations in this country and the world, really, to keep this area of history confused or obfuscated?
I don't understand why there is such a big cover-up or an effort to extinguish the ancient knowledge of this country. They want everybody to believe and fall in line that that there was a land bridge across the Bering Strait, and then people walked across the Bering Strait. Now, what did they eat? I don't know. I think that if such was the case, they probably came in boats. But that entire land bridge over the Bering Strait is all predicated and codified by American scholars using the Nadine Native American language. And that's one of the things that I proved, is that these languages are horribly, horribly diverse from each other. All these dialects that they claim were all similar in the same language family, they're all completely different. Completely different.
Now, you consider yourself a diffractionist?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
Not a diffusionist.
Define those words, if you will.
Diffusionist is someone who believes that Mediterraneans or Europeans had gotten here before Columbus, be them Vikings, be them from Egypt or Spain or anywhere like that, or even the Chinese for that matter, okay? And so that's what is a diffusionist. And so I consider myself a diffractionist because I go way past that and attempt to actually prove it. And I don't think that there's any effort at all to prove that the Vikings were here before Columbus, and it appears to me that there were other British fishing fleets that were here, or even Welsh or Irish or even Icelandic peoples here, on and on through the ages. I have no problem with that, but then when you find a repository that's got all kinds of Latin scripted tablets, Egyptian hieroglyph, Greek, Numidian, Demotic, all these different ancient languages, Punic in there. That's why I call myself a diffractionist.
Because you have the evidence.
More so, yeah, that's it, yeah. It's not speculation anymore. It becomes hard fact.
I would think, Harry, that there would be scholars, historians, archaeologists from all over the world flocking to this area.
Many have come here. I entertain scholars from Europe here occasionally. I've even had some visitors from Japan, and they can't figure it out either. And the thing about it is the all of the top brass in the Illinois Historic Preservation Society, if it's not a piece of pottery or an arrowhead, then it's fake. It doesn't matter if you find an ancient coin 30 feet in the ground that comes up when some people are drilling a well or so. Oh, well, that's a fake coin. Somebody put it there. Or a tablet that's got script on it, or a tablet that's carved with a beautiful scene on it. Oh, it must be a fake. And that's the mindset. That's just the way they're educated to think, and they're not going to deviate from it. They can lose their credibility. They can lose their grants. And that's all that most professors are worried about, is getting the next grant, and that's what they do. That's beyond that, you got me.
Well, Harry, this is really interesting material that you are bringing forth, and over 2 decades of hard work decoding, translating script and putting it on websites and on YouTube. And if you could, tell listeners about your websites and how to learn more about your work.
Okay, well, there's a lot of videos, which you've covered some on YouTube, and there's several on Vimeo. There are at alexanderhelios.com. There's books of two. I've written two books. There's two books available and some other stuff. And our main website is IllinoisCaves.com. And we're also on Facebook at The Illinois Caves. And there's a lot of good pictures on the Facebook page. You scroll down there, and there's links to other videos. There's a lot out there. And I just want to point out that so many of the naysayers, they'll say something like, oh, that language is wrong, you did this. But they can't point out any mistakes in any of the translations or any of the history. There are no mistakes in anything. We've been very meticulous. It's easy to call fake on something, but I've had so many of the artifacts authenticated. And so there we have it. It's just easy to say, oh, people look at some of these artifacts, oh, that's fake. And they've never even seen or held the artifacts. You know, they've never seen them under a microscope or anything. They just, oh, it's just fake. It's easy to say that.
Well, we're talking about thousands and thousands of artifacts. I'm not
Correct.
Saying that they couldn't be fake, but my guess is they're not certainly based on a lot of your work authenticating the artifacts themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Harry Hubbard, I want to thank you for being on Another News, and we'll definitely continue these interviews because there's so much area to cover.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'd be delighted.
Well, okay, I look forward to it as well. Thank you very much. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady.